Hey, hey, have you heard? It's your host, Chris DeMakes, and I'm headed back to the Punk Rock Museum. That's right, the powers that be have invited me back, and I couldn't be more excited. Allow me to be your guide as we wind through five decades of punk rock history, merchandise, and memorabilia. Cinco de Mayo weekend, Friday, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. There'll be two tours each day at 12:30 p.m. and 4 p.m. And the best part for me is you. Your stories, your questions, your experiences. Yep, some of you old punkers have taught this guy a thing or two on these tours, and I love it. Head over to thepunkrockmuseum.com for tickets. Don't miss out, only 30 spots per tour. Get your tickets now at thepunkrockmuseum.com.
Hey everyone, today's guest is Mick Conroy, bassist for the Colchester, England new wave band, Modern English. Together, we take a deep dive into the writing, recording, and inspiration behind the smash hit single, I Melt With You, taken from their 1982 album, After the Snow. Mick was an absolute pleasure to talk to, and was quick to credit producer Hugh Jones with pulling the reins on the band, getting them to be a bit more constrained and focused than they were on their first record, where they had more of an anything-goes attitude. Mick recalled that it was the spring of 1982. The weather was warming up a bit in England, and there was an overall feeling of optimism within the band that definitely shows in the track. The studio where they worked didn't have a lot of gear, but they made do with what they had, and the results speak for themselves. This 40-year-old song is still everywhere. I asked Mick if he still gets a kick out of playing it live, and he answered with a resounding yes. He's grateful for the song, all the doors that it's opened for the band, and continues to open. So for all this and a whole lot more, stick around.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Chris DeMakes a podcast.
Hey, Mick, how you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. This is really cool how this happened. One of my band, Less Than Jake's former producer, Steve Kravac, is doing live sound for you. I saw him post something the other day, and I hit him up and said, oh my gosh, if we could get someone from Modern English to be on my songwriting podcast, I would be elated, and here you are. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, well done, Steve Kravac, and well done for spotting it. Yeah, we've worked with Steve for about, 6 years now. He's part of the furniture. Good guy.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. So your story's amazing. I mean, 40 years on, and here we are talking about a track that you wrote all the way back then. Did you ever think you'd still be talking about this when you wrote this as a young man?
And absolutely not. I mean, I've listened to a couple of your podcasts, and generally, people have said the same thing. You know, it's like it was. I listened to the Toto Africa podcast. It's classic the way songs that you know the band in the studio are thinking. I'm not sure about this one. Is it going to make the album? And then it does, and it walks off and has a life of its own. We had no idea. Absolutely none.
I guess if anyone were to ever say to me, oh yeah, we knew this was going to be a smash, I'd probably have to step back for a moment and go, wait a second, are they pulling my leg here, you know? Because how would you know?
Nice.
You know, especially when you're that young, none of us were thinking, I wasn't thinking about money. I just wanted to maybe, you know, if people showed up to the pub to see me play, I could get maybe a beer or two out of it. That was a home run, right?
Yeah, I mean, when like you said, it was 40 years ago, you know, our hope was that John Peel might play it, you know.
Right.
You know, you know, if it gets played on late night radio, we're kind of validated, you know. It's like someone likes it who's, you know, he can play it to other people. We weren't so, you know, arrogant that we thought we were like onto something. We just, you know, we were just doing another track on the album.
Right. And for those outside of the UK, John Peel just renowned in England, basically kind of like, you know, we had Dick Clark over here, you know,
yeah.
American Bandstand. John, if you got on John Peel or Top of the Pops, like that was something.
Yeah. I mean, John Peel was even more alternative. You know, it was what you heard during the daytime on BBC Radio 1 was, you know, like top 40 radio here in America, you know, and, you know, it would have to be like, you know, John Peel was like the equivalent of, you know, going to Boston and hear, you know, the town, the city of Boston, and hearing college radio in America for the first time. You know, you'd hear things like REM and, you know, Susie and the Banshees on suddenly, you know, these college radio stations. Even in England, it was during the daytime, it was pure pop.
Right. Well, the band formed in 1979 in Colchester, Essex, in England, which is northeast of the London area, not too far. And Mick plays the bass and sings for the band. You're an original member, as well as Robbie Gray on vocals and Gary McDowell on guitar and vocals. And the band for this recording was rounded out by Richard Brown on the drums and Stephen Walker on the keyboards. And in 1979, you guys signed to 4AD Records. Your debut album, Mesh and Lace, was released in 81. And your second album, After the Snow, was released in May of 82. And that featured I Melt With You. And I mean, I know that you've definitely lived this, but I was just thinking as I'm going through this song the past couple of days, I've heard this song everywhere. I heard it at college parties. I heard it at punk rock parties. I heard it coming out of the mall. I heard it at the doctor's office. It's just one of those songs that's woven into the fabric of society.
Yes, to all of the above. I mean,
yeah. Sorry for stating the obvious, but it's incredible.
It's completely true. You know, you know, you don't really get you know, elevator music anymore. You know, but I, you know, my ambition, my hope is that one day I get into a lift and I can hear, you know, like a, you know, just a background, you know, cheesy version of the song, even though there have been cheesy versions of it recorded.
Yes, and I found several of them on YouTube.
There's a guy called Richard Cheese.
Yes.
I mean, his version is, when I first heard it, I thought, God, you know, what have we done?
I'll stop the world and melt with you. You've seen the difference, and it's getting better all the time. And there's nothing you and I won't do. I'll stop the world and melt with you.
It's just nice to hear so many different versions of it as well. I mean, there's hundreds on YouTube.
Well, and speaking of versions, I want to get into that in a moment, but the album was produced by the band and Hugh Jones. And Hugh Jones is also known for Echo and the Bunnymen, The Sound, and The Damned, among others, a fantastic producer. And something really cool. I loved this movie back in the day. 1983, Nicolas Cage starred in a romantic comedy called Valley Girl, and I Melt With You was featured in the film. And of course, it was all over this new thing back then called music television, MTV. And, you know, I did a little research on this because, Mick, we're going to talk about the single version today, the single edit that was used in the video, which is about 19 seconds shorter than the album version. There's a couple little differences. One of the biggest differences is the single edit was mixed in mono. And I think I know why. MTV back then, they may have had stereo capability, but most of the TVs were in mono. Is that correct?
Do you know what? When we recorded the song, honestly, we had no idea, you know, that television, MTV, being in the movies, you know, Valley Girl, was ever going to happen. It was purely because, you know, this was 1982, and singles, if they got played on the you know, radio station, people had mono radios. They had transistor radios,
right?
And also we liked the you know, like the old Beatles and Rolling Stones records. They were all recorded in mono. You know, mm-hmm. You know, straight down the middle. You know, and Sony Walkmans. I don't even know if people you know, had Sony Walkmans at the time, you know.
They were, if they did, they were just coming out. Yeah. You know, Mick, you just set up the middle. And for the listeners, you know, mono is just, everything's there. And stereo, you're getting a stereo mix, which means a right and a left mix. That's why a lot of times on the show, I'll talk about, oh, this guitar came in here, panned off to the left. And I'll tell you, listening to the mono version, it's great. It's the version everyone pretty much knows. When you listen to that album version, wow, there's stuff panned off, and it's a great mix.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I part of my homework, I was thinking, I've got to listen to I'm Out With You Again.
Even though you're going to probably play it on tour in a day or two.
Yeah. But, you know, I actually made some notes down, and I was thinking about how... I had a feeling you'd talk about the 7-inch, and
yes.
I just wrote mono. So I was thinking, I don't have to worry about any, you know, pans or, you know, I think on, you know, the album version, there's the, you know, the piano comes in on the Futures Open Wide.
Yes.
I have a feeling that might be stereo and going across, but on the single, I mean, it's quite a catchy little piano part, you know. I think
that, oh, it's unreal.
You know, I think it's, everything is just kind of in your face, as we would say.
Yeah.
You know, I do remember, you know, we recorded it at Rockfield in Wales, the residential studio. It's quite a famous studio.
Right, yeah.
You know, I mean, you're a muso, you go to enough studios, you know, and it's like, you know, in when you're young, you put them on the biggest speakers possible, you know.
Yeah.
So you're kind of being like, you know, and we'd kind of like do the, you know, switch it from mono to stereo to see how much difference it made, you know.
Yeah.
We thought, wow, you know, it's not much different. But then, of course, you go down from the big studio speakers to the NS10s. You know, mm-hmm. the Yamahas. And then in those days, it would be a small Roberts transistor radio. Then you'd go down to, you know, the radio, so you could hear it on a very small speaker. There, you know, there was a possible, you know, we thought, well, this is definitely the poppiest song, the catchiest song on the album. So there's a chance it could be released as a single. We finally did the mono version later on, you know, but we'd test everything, because, you know, when you got down to the single speaker of the Roberts radio, everything's in mono anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here at home, I am, you know, for walking around, I have one of these, you know, a boat revolve thing or whatever they're called.
Sure.
You know, I only have one, so it's a bit like everything's in mono in my world anyway.
Bluetooth speaker, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I've got a JBL thing that's about this wide, and sometimes I find I've got my nose up against it to see if I can hear.
Well, something I know you can agree with, I've said this before, nothing sounds better than a recording you're proud of in the studio when the engineer or producer pushes up all the faders and they're coming through those big speakers you're talking. It just, you're like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing I ever heard. And then you get the cassette out to the car and you're like, okay, it's still good, but it doesn't sound like it did in there.
Yeah. I mean, I do. I'm in New York now, but in England, you know, our bases where me and Lobby also live there, I have a studio, and you know, I'm forever going into my car, you know, to see what it sounds like in my
sure,
you know, just, you know, compared to what I was listening to earlier. Then I put on it, you know, it's like mix one, or sorry, bounce one, and then 10 minutes later, bounce two, until you get to like definitely final bounce seven guitar on left hand side. And I'm forever in my car, and the car is, you know, it's quite a good judge of what you're doing, you know, listening to what you've mixed in a car.
Especially if you listen to all your other music in there, that's a great gauge.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, often you wonder why, you know, when you're in the studio and you listen to stuff from the big speakers, you know that no one else, hardly anyone experiences stuff like that.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like how studios make their money. You know, we've got, mm-hmm. speakers that, you know, sound amazing.
Well, I got to tell you something. I'm sitting here chuckling inside because I spent about 20 minutes last night with my producer, Chris, freaking out about there's a mono mix for the single, but the album version is the stereo. And then they also re-recorded a version in 1990. What do we talk about? Which yeah. you're just so nonchalant. You're like, oh yeah, the mono version. So this is great. We're going to talk about the single version. And speaking of that 1990 version, I did listen to that. And what was the reason for re-recording it then? Was it a label issue? You know, if you, a lot of times we have re-record rights. If we re-record something, we could use it for car commercials, etc.
We'd spent a few years of being quite dormant, me and Robbie, after our fourth album. And TVT Records in New York, they, I mean, the guy who ran that, Steve Gottlieb, was convinced that, I'm Out With You could have done better. And so he basically signed us up and said, you know, you really should do I'm Out With You again. And, you know, we thought, you know, how much? And he went, and we said, okay, you know, and, you know, we, it was our first time actually, you know, I mean, you know, I love all music and there's so many different versions that people do of songs anyway. And, you know, like David Bowie, how many times has he re-recorded Space Oddity or done different versions of Heroes?
You know, Eric Clapton did Layla. I mean, there's been tons of them, but in this instance, this was pretty much like the original version, just, you know, sounded different because technology, I think, got different in 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, but, I mean, we still recorded that onto multi-track. You know, the first time, you know, 2-inch tape, when we did the first one, we only had 24 tracks. And then when we did it the second time, there was a 48 track, you know, two machines going around, you know, which that was in about 1989. And we'd already started to use stuff like Notator and Creator, which was like forerunner to Logic, which you're using now.
Yeah.
And that everyone uses, or Pro Tools. But I still think the original version, the Hugh Jones one that we did, is the most charming of the ones that we've done.
Yeah. Yeah, you're calling it charming. I'm calling it magical. There's something about that one. There's a spirit of that one. And there's been bands that re-recorded stuff that captures the spirit better. Very rarely I find that, you know. And in this instance, there's just something about that original track that it's just awesome.
I think a lot of that has to do with the studio, Rockfield. I mean, there's so many amazing records that have been made. I mean, you know, I don't know if you saw the Queen film. Bohemian.
Yes.
Okay, well, that, you know, they're in Rockfield in that film, you know, well, the actors are, you know, and there's a...
Yeah.
And I think, wow, you know, they actually are in Rockfield, except they had a chandelier, you know, for Freddie Mercury's scene. They're not a chandelier, it's a studio.
Well, yeah, they gotta build the movie up a little bit, but
yeah.
In all, you guys have released 8 records. Your most recent one was Take Me to the Trees in 2016, and last year, for the 40th anniversary of the album After the Snow and I Melt With You, you guys did a Tonight Show appearance with Jimmy Fallon that was just absolutely fantastic. You guys sound like you did 40 years ago. I'll stop the world, it melts with you. You see the difference, and it's getting better all the time. There's nothing you and I won't do. I'll stop the world, it melts with you. There was a great day. I mean, I think that was the first time in absolutely ages that we'd actually done anything on television. And it was so, it was a really good show to be on, obviously, you know, it was like really exciting, you know, that we were on the Jimmy Fallon show. And I mean, he was such a nice guy, you know, and he was, you know, genuinely really excited about it. You know, you kind of think, I wonder what he got up to, you know, 40 years ago when this record was, you know, people have, they have so many kind of like, you know, stories, like most people will tell you, you know,
that people have, you know, everyone has a story that's related to, you know, I'm out with you. Some of them are, you can't repeat, and others are just a nod and a wink, and you kind of get the idea.
Well, I heard this song coming out of my clock radio in 1982 when I was 9 years old, the mono version, because my clock radio was definitely mono. Okay. So I wasn't getting up much to then, Mick. I'll tell you, though, about 10 years later, when I was in college at the University of Florida in Gainesville, I definitely did some partying to this song. So it's, and we'll save that for another podcast. That's all I'll say about that. But I want to jump into the mono single edit right now of I Melt With You. 3 minutes and 50 seconds, 8-bar intro, insanely danceable swing on the drum groove here, along with bass, keyboards, I think clean guitar, and is that a 12-string acoustic on there?
Actually, do you know, I think it's there was a 12-string, and there's also an Ovation guitar.
Because it's interesting. It sounds kind of chorusy, which I almost thought at first, maybe this is just two acoustics playing, but I'm like, no, I think there's a 12-string in there.
Yeah, and also it's going through a Leslie speaker.
Okay, that's what... Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, one really good thing about Hugh Jones is that, you know, on our earlier recordings, it was like loads of noise, effects, pedals, and, you know, it's quite chaotic, our first album and our first earlier recordings. Hugh kind of reined us in a bit, and everything he went for was, you know, natural. There's a distorted guitar that's generally for a Vox AC30. Microphones, the distance, and doors are open for corridors. There's, you know, all of that. But the intro is definitely, you know, I'm quite sure it's a Leslie. I know we put a lot of guitars through the Leslie. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of at Rockfield, there's an Echoplex room as well. Further down, that we'd put a cabin and a mic in there as well.
For the listeners, a Leslie is a it's like a speaker that kind of rotates. How would you describe it? It rotates the sound and gives it this almost flangey type. It's awesome.
Yeah, they're made for Hammond organs originally, and you know, it gives it a kind of like a chorus type. I think the word is you know, a Doppler effect. You know, like a police siren.
Yeah.
You know, when Nina, not exactly sure where the sound's coming from because it's being pointed in different directions.
And it's super cool that, you know, you brought up that producer Hugh Jones kind of reined you guys in, because even with this track, and we'll get into it, there's so much going on. And I think the reason that the track allows so much to go on, like the keyboard parts and the guitar parts are so busy underneath the vocals, it shouldn't work. But it does, and I think it's because the whole song only goes between C major and F major for the whole thing except the two musical interludes that happen in the track. And again, we'll get there, not trying to get too far ahead of myself, but as I'm going through this song, I'm like, how? There's so many times my band, it's like, yeah, but I got this great guitar part. It's like, yeah, but it's stepping all over the vocal. I'm like, but the guitar part's great. Like, the vocal's better. Your guitar part's not going in there, you know? And in here, there's just so much stuff. After we get out of this intro, we get into verse one.
Moving forwards, using all my breath. Making love to you was never second best. I saw the world crashing all around your face. Never really knowing it was always mesh and lace.
I know you didn't write the lyrics, Mick, but I'm gonna read these and have you set them up as best as you can. Did Robbie write this lyric?
Rob did, and with a lot of guidance from Hugh. I mean, with modern English, it's like the music's always done first. And before we started recording the album, we did a lot of pre-production with Hugh, so we knew what we were doing. Keyboards are always done last in the studio. And vocals are always done, you know, the vocals are the very last thing that goes on. In rehearsals, we were in the studio in London, Alaska, rehearsal studio. Robbie would, you know, there'd be a lot of kind of him, you know, spitting out words, lyrics, melodies, etc., etc. And that "I'll Stop the World and Melt with You" was definitely in there. And he was fighting furiously, you know, to try and kind of like keep up with everyone. It's definitely Rob who navigated the lyrics of that one.
One more thing before we get into verse one, I wanted to mention about the intro. It's doing this like tom thing with the drums, and yeah, it's actually the chorus feel of what's happening there in the intro. But verse one lyrics: "Moving forward, using all my breath. Making love to you was never second best. I saw the world thrashing all around your face. Never really knowing it was always mesh and lace." Which I have to ask, on that last line there, "Mesh and Lace" was the title of your debut record.
Correct.
Yeah, so was that just a kind of fun lyric to throw in there for maybe the fans, or you know, how'd that come about?
Yeah, I mean, it was "Mesh and Lace" was kind of like good, bad, yin, yang, you know, black, white. And don't forget, we were very young, so it was, you know, imagery was, you know, it was quite important to us, especially with our artwork that we had. And, you know, these lyrics have been analysed so many times, and I've heard Rob on occasions tell us a completely different story about what they mean.
And I love that, because I've done that before too. You get bored. Hey, I've told this story 30 times. I'm going to make something up.
Yeah, yeah.
Is "mesh and lace" an English colloquialism? I haven't heard that term used before.
No. It was we had a song called "Mesh and Lace," and it didn't actually make the album. The first "Mesh and Lace" album, that's why we called it "Mesh and Lace." But the chorus for that song was "trapped in a maze of mesh and lace." I thought it was quite a good line for Rob. And then we called the album "Mesh and Lace." And then, you know, Rob chucked in "never really knowing it was always mesh and lace," you know, which was kind of like possibly being in a maze, trapped, you know.
Okay. And do you know if this was autobiographical, biographical, or was he just writing a story?
We didn't really write love songs, but I think, you know, I don't want to, you know, preempt Robbie, in case he ever hears this. But I mean,
you're still in a band with him. You might never hear the end of it.
Yeah. It was definitely a love song. I think it was dedicated to someone in his head.
Fair enough. Well, the drums go to a straight beat here in verse one, along with a great bouncy bass line. The bass tone on this, not because you're in front of me, I'm telling you, it is so good. And how the parts just all work together here is great. And a clean, almost sounds like a hollow body guitar, is playing a fairly busy riff, kind of the hook of the song that somehow perfectly exists with the lead vocal here. It just somehow, you're allowed to have this moving guitar part with this vocal. And again, a lot of times I've heard producers say it, there's too much going on here. And was that ever a discussion? There was too much going on here.
I mean, like I said, Hugh reined us in. The bass line, there's actually two bass lines in the verse. You know, it does that do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you remember a band called the Rosillos?
Not familiar with their stuff, but I know the name.
I think you'd really like them. They had a song called "I Love My Baby Because She Does Good Sculptures." Yeah. And the song, I mean, they were like a punk rock band. And, you know, obviously no one was a brilliant musician. And it was just like two notes. E, A, kind of thing. And I always liked that song. But then I had a more busy bass line, and I actually wanted to use the busier bass line, which is the second half of the verse. And he said, do something more simple for the first part of that. And so it gives, you know, Gary a chance to kind of weave his way through.
Yeah.
You know, basically the bass, you know, on that song, the bass and drums were recorded first. Then the guitar parts were, I mean, it was definitely more worked on in the studio, you know, what Gary would play. You know, and initially, I think in rehearsals, it was just a bass and drums and a vocal kind of like guide. I know it shouldn't work, but it does. You have to kind of be on the groove.
It's hard to explain. I'm sure some of the listeners are going, I don't understand what he means by it doesn't work. It totally works here, but it's just typically you don't have something that busy behind a vocal. You know, it's just it's awesome, though. I marvel at it. Chorus one comes quickly, 37 seconds. And yeah, that's pretty quick. The drums go back to that intro feel on the floor tom, the kick and snare, with clean guitar chords strummed on the one beat, with bass, acoustic guitar, and a synth part running with everything here. And again, the synth part is busy like that other guitar lick. This synth lick is really busy in this chorus, but it completely works. I'll stop the world and melt with you. You've seen the difference, and it's getting better all the time. There's nothing you and I won't do. I'll stop the world and melt with you. We should go faster. I gotta ask, were the vocals doubled in the chorus?
I'm quite sure they are. Yeah, I mean, okay. They would have possibly been tripled, you know, like, you know, one of those things, we didn't really know it until it happened, that Rob's actually really good at double tracking. Before, we used to use, I mean, I'm sure you remember, but, you know, like 16-track studios. And so you'd be running out of space, and there used to be this ADT machine. Automatic double tracking. They were what John Lennon used to use, the Beatles. They were made by Abbey Road people. It was like a slight off, you know, so it sounded like two people were talking at the same time.
Yes.
I mean, now they have them in Logic. I think Waves make them.
Right. And basically, instead of having to sing it twice, you're singing it once, but it's splitting it off by just a couple nanoseconds or something to make it sound like there's two.
If we ever got the chance, it was like Robbie would always double track, you know, choruses anyway, just to make it sound, you know, it's like, here's the chorus, there's more of the singer.
For sure. Well, the lyric is, I'll stop the world and melt with you. You've seen the difference, and it's getting better all the time. There's nothing you and I won't do. I'll stop the world and melt with you. And I noticed right off the bat, heard this song a million times, but it's interesting. It starts with the lyric, I'll stop the world and melt with you, and it ends with it. And I know there's other songs that do that. Off the top of my head, I can't think of them right now. I know there's other ones, but it's great when the hook is that strong that you can have it lead off the chorus and have it end it. On the second line here, it starts off unison on one of those doubles. You've seen the difference, but then you get a harmony on the back half, and it's getting better all the time. That's the only harmony that comes in there. And another thing I have to ask, are there hand claps on the snare here?
Quite probably. You know, this is one of the... I'm quite sure there are. I've got loads of hand claps and stuff in my, you know, folders that in Logic way back there. Occasionally, I get the Rockfield hand claps out for demos.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah. But there's definitely hand claps in there. And any other people that you talk to have recorded at Rockfield will tell you there's a corridor along the live room. It's a great big old barn, and the doors open and mics are put outside. So, and it just sounds, you know, that it's all like natural reverb going on in there. So, and claps and snares. I mean, Simple Minds did their Empires and Dance, the American song, a couple of albums at Rockfield, you know, when really big snare sounds were coming in the early 80s. I mean, Robert Plant was there when we were there with Cozy Powell getting big 80s snare sounds.
Hey, everybody, we got to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors, but we got lots more with Mick Conroy coming up after the break.
Hey, you, do you have any plans this year? How's that going? Did you get 2020'd? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020'd, where myself, Benny Goodman, And my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to the show.
Right out of chorus one, we go into verse two.
Dream of better lives, the kind which never hate. Wrapped in a state of imaginary grace. I made a pilgrimage to save this human race. Never comprehending the race at long gone by.
Same instrumentation as verse one. And here you get these call and response vocals that are happening that were not on the album version.
Yeah.
Why all of a sudden did you guys decide, was this something that producer Hugh Jones thought that was needed for a single version?
Right, yeah. So we were on 4AD Records, which was a record label that was above a record shop, Beggar's Banquet. They're all part of the same thing. And, you know, 4AD was, you know, like there was a desk over here and Beggar's Banquet was like three desks put together. You know, it was like basically at the time, people in the office started to hear it, thinking, bloody hell, this, you know, modern English, this sounds a bit different for them. And so normally you just put a single out, whereas for this it was decided that we should make it shorter and go back to the studio and do backing vocals and make it more like a classic old-fashioned 7-inch single, you know, that's already... We just didn't have time when we were in Rockfield. And then when we got there, the vocals kind of came out of thin air. You know, we should know better. We should know CY. Let's stop the world. It took us, 8 hours to do the entire mix and chuck on those vocals. And moved the keyboards, because on the album version, the keyboards don't even appear on the first chorus. And we cut the second bridge, The Future's Open Wide.
Yes.
As well. So it was a bit like, but it's a 7-inch, you know, let's just chuck everything in.
Well, I got to tell you, when I went back and listened to the album version, it sounds naked to me now.
Yeah.
Because the single version's the one that everybody hears, that I've heard a million times, you know. Here's something else I could not discern, and maybe you can clear it up, because you just said we, but it sounds like that backing vocal, and it starts off verse two. Is it we should know better or you should know better? Because it sounds like you and we on that first note, like there's two voices, someone saying you and someone saying we.
Well, I'm going to have to listen to it. It's probably did happen. And, you know, how sometimes when you're in the studio and you kind of like fluff something and mm-hmm. you come back in and you think, should I mention it and see if anyone else knows?
Yeah.
If they don't, you just carry on. You think, like, okay, you know, but only you know. Maybe because Hugh did Hugh was the backing vocalist on the entire album.
Oh, okay. So Hugh did some backing vocals, and that's interesting. And maybe it was a situation where, yeah, maybe it was both said. Someone else came in and said we while he said you. But it starts off, you should know better. Dream of better lives, the kind which never hate. And that backing vocal, you should know why. Or we should know why.
Yeah.
Trapped in the state of imaginary grace, you should know better. I made a pilgrimage to save this human's race. You should see why. Never comprehending the race had long gone by. Amazing harmony on that last line. Same instrumentation as verse one and verse two here, but where do you think he's going here with the lyrics, Mick?
I mean, the lyrics are incredible. It's full of hope, you know, that he's talking about there. And, you know, just what could be and what we, I mean, when we were working and doing that album, we were absolutely dirt poor. You know, we lived in a squat in London, and you know, it was then we were transformed to Wales, Rockfield, you know, for 6 weeks. And it was, I know this sounds really a bit of a cliche, but it was, we called it in about March. So it was like spring was happening, you know, and we were in this amazingly beautiful countryside. And it was impossible to be, you know, too gloomy, you know. And, you know, we were in a residential place and we were being, you know, that it was just a really, it was a really good time for us. And I think, you know, optimism as well. And we were kind of like, everyone was really enjoying the process of the recording. And, you know, with Rob, he'll quite often, you know, at the last minute change lyrics. You know, it's like, you know, a line might be quite down, and then suddenly he wakes up in a much better mood and thinks, do you know what? I'm going to change back to everything is amazing.
Well, that's awesome to hear. Yeah, it's like, you know, you guys don't get a lot of days of sun over in the UK. So it's springtime. You know, you're seeing the rabbits outside the studio and the birds are, you know, chirping, and it had to be a good feeling.
Yeah. I mean, it was. Yeah, I mean it's so long ago, but I remember, you know, it being a, you know, we were just having a really good time making really good music.
It sounds like it. Well, chorus two starts off with a backing vocal very reminiscent of what was going on in verse two. I'll stop the world and melt with you. Let's Stop the World is the backing vocal, and then it goes lead backing vocal for the rest of it. I'll stop the world and melt with you. Let's stop the world. You've seen the difference, and it's getting better all the time. Let's stop the world. There's nothing you and I won't do. Let's stop the world. I'll stop the world and melt with you. And you get a great harmony on that. You've seen the difference and it's getting better all the time line. Same instrumentation as chorus one, except that synth part is now played up an octave here. Okay, that wasn't on the original recording on the record, but you did put that lower octave synth part in chorus one. Now it's up here, and man, it just lifts this chorus. It's so good.
Yeah, that was Hugh. I mean, was you know, he was in charge of octaves and pretty much keyboards there. I mean, there's so many things that, you know, we learned from Hugh Jones, and it was even though it's a 7-inch, it's still kind of like making things happen, you know, and kind of like the interest. I mean, hardly anyone, people, you know, like I said, you're a muso, you know, most people don't even notice this kind of stuff, you know. It's almost like, I wonder who will notice this if I kind of play that line back to front this time around, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's a common, you know, studio ploy, you know, it's a kind of, you know, it's like you might have heard it the first time around, but we're going to make sure you hear it the second time.
Yeah, it's so good. It just completely, it's like it's the same chorus, but it's not because of that. And of course, you're getting in those backing call and response vocals, which are great. At the end of chorus two, we get our first chord change outside of the C major to F major. For the first interlude and the second interlude, it's the same chorus progression. We get E minor, G, A minor to C. And it's just such a relief at that point in both spots. And the first four bars, the drums go to a new tom snare shuffle here with the bass. Sounds like a guitar is doing harmonics here. A piano is slightly maybe detuned with some delay here. And on the sixth bar of eight, you get the lyric, "The future's open wide." That lyric right there, it sounds like there's a couple voices saying that that are really reverbed out. It's a cool, cool sound.
That whole section was, you know, when we started the album with Hugh, we had lots of bits and bobs and songs, you know, floating around. That section was actually originally a different song. That was kind of like a bit of a hangover from the first album, Mesh and Lace. You know, it starts on E minor. How doomy can you get?
Yeah. Well, this is crazy that you say this because I totally agree. It could be its own separate song. And I've mentioned this on the show before. Have you ever written something where you say, I can't waste this on a bridge part? This is too cool. And to that point, maybe your thinking was, well, it's so cool that we have to do it again because it happens again, which is weird. That's another weird part of this song, how, you know, after this, we're going to go to a chorus right back to it, but it's so great.
Yeah. I mean, that whole part of the song was, that was where Hugh really came in. You know, I mean, he was, you know, dominant and present throughout. But and it was originally the Futures Open Wide section was a lot slower. But Richard, the drummer, we had that kind of like, you know, floor tom kind of thing going off anyway, which Richard was really good at that kind of drumming, you know, kind of like, you know, less fall to the floor type stuff kind of thing.
I feel like he straddles the line perfectly between rock drummer and dance drummer because there's something so danceable about this song.
Yeah. When we started, you know, working with Hugh, we'd never played to a click track. So, you know, that was our first album. You know, you can listen. Once I did an interview and the guy said to me, there's an amazing tempo change on one of the songs, as if we did it deliberately. But I said,
right.
You know, that was take two and that was all the time we had for. And, you know, we didn't know that there was a tempo, you know, that it shifted that quickly. You know, so it's like Richard, the drummer, had, you know, like a Dr. Rhythm click track going in his headphones all of the time. And,
right.
You know, with a lot of the tape was edited, you know, or lots of drop-ins were occurring, you know, because, you know, as I said, we were very young and didn't really, you know, before you just do a fill, you know, and hope for the best, you know, on the next section, you know, whereas with this, it had to be kind of like a bit more regimented.
This whole section, you know, that guitar lick that comes in is so cool. It starts creeping in, followed by an eight bars of this synth solo. And the whole band is in here, drums, bass, acoustic guitar. And there's also the intro guitar lick being played with a keyboard lick now together near the end of this musical interlude. It's so great.
I think that's just guitar.
Is that just guitar?
Yeah. I mean, the only keyboards on this record are the piano in the Futures Open Wide and the da-da-da-da-da-da in the chorus. It's all, the guitars would have been, again, you know, all of the lead stuff. There was JC-120, AC-30, a Marshall and the Leslie all going... Mm. Same time, you know, or obviously individually, but then all put in together.
So I'm hearing some delay overtones or something that I was thinking was a keyboard. It's awesome.
That would be a really old Lexicon Echo that that we had in the studio. Even though it's a great studio, there wasn't that much equipment that you know, outboard effects and stuff like that. But so we used that Lexicon a lot on, you know, you know, some people would use an Eventide harmonizer a lot as their go-to thing. That we use the Echo.
Yeah, you know, you said there wasn't much, you know, outboard stuff to use or whatever, so you use what you had to get the job done.
Yeah. It was a bit like, you know, it would be, you know, we'd either have to kind of use it in the chorus or a verse. You know, we couldn't use it in both because one had a different setting. You know,
right. Well, the chorus three comes right out of this musical interlude. I'll stop the world and melt with you. the same lyrics as the previous time, except for the third line. I've seen some changes, but it's getting better all the time. And do you remember if that was a Hugh suggestion or who suggested, hey, we should change it up here for chorus three? Because every other chorus is the same.
I knew you were going to ask some tricky questions. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to have to ask Rob about that.
Yeah, it's only on chorus three. When we come back to chorus four later in the song, it goes back to the original lyric of "You've seen the difference, and it's getting better all the time." And
do you know what? I'm going to ask Rob. I mean, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Rob goes, "Really? I'd completely forgotten about that." It's like years ago, I once mentioned to the keyboard player, you don't play in the first chorus, you know, and you go like, if we're playing live, you know, he'll still come in. And I say, you know, on the single, Steve, it's like the second chorus, but he, you know, goes, yeah, whatever.
That's awesome. Well, out of chorus three, we have what I'm calling musical interlude two. It's about the same as the first one. It's 8 bars total. But there's some great, and I could be wrong here with all the stuff you're telling me, but it sounds like great guitar feedback is throughout this one, as opposed to the first one. That is guitar.
Yeah.
Okay. And I have to ask, was there ever anybody, Hugh, or anybody that said, it's weird to go back to this musical interlude. We just did it, and we did a chorus, and now we're back to it. Because I don't think it's weird at all. It's amazing.
You know, initially when Hugh, I mean, I'm still really good friends with Hugh, and he still always says that when I first played him, I Melt With You, I said, hey, it's a bit too poppy. And he said, are you out of your mind? And I said, no. And he said, there's nothing wrong with pop. You know, whereas we thought the future's open wide section was the one that was more not where we were coming from. So we were perfectly happy to have it in twice without there was no problem for us to have that part in there twice. And also we like the kind of like you said, C to F. No one can be annoyed by those two chords because they ring so purely, you know. But chucking an E minor after it, it's kind of like, whoa.
Yeah, it's a bit jarring, but it's not jarring here. And that's what's interesting about it. You know, it feels like it's just, it was perfectly sewn together.
Yeah. It's almost like having a bit of a breather, you know, it kind of calms everything down for a second or two. It definitely works.
For sure. Well, when we get out of this musical interlude, we get into, I guess if there's a bridge in this song, Mick, or as the English would say, a middle eight, this, I guess, would be the part. And this is probably the most interesting part of the song to me. For nothing else, it's simplicity. It's simplicity, but it's effectiveness. And it's a double-tracked vocal for 8 bars, just kind of doing this, it's humming the melody, and the bass is moving between those C and F notes. Yeah, again, simple but so effective.
Yes, I mean, I don't think anyone really knows where the came from, but Rob would hum quite often, like I was saying, when he's trying to get melodies and vocal ideas, and just like that. And part of I Melt With You as well was me trying to rip off Walk on the Wild Side.
Yeah, she says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side.
That's really interesting because I don't hear that, but okay.
No, great. This is it. You know, it's like, to, but, you know, I'd always been like playing around with that as well. And, you know, of course, tempos get changed the more you kind of routine and work out a song. And it was like when we finally came, I mean, I'm out with you, it's 158, which is like insane, you know, like BPM. So I really wanted to have a kind of like a tribute to Walk on the Wild Side or a nod in there. And that was that. And it just kind of, you know, it worked.
You know, what's interesting about the part is that, you know, you said that Robbie be walking around. We all do it as singers. You're warming up between takes. It almost sounded like he might have been like, you know, coming back from the toilet or something, or walking back in the control room and just humming. And Hugh or someone went, that's brilliant.
Yes. Yeah. It was one of the interviews that you did recently. You said, did anyone film it? And the person said, no, iPhones weren't invented then. You know, this was like a very long time ago. But, you know, it's like someone walked through a door doing something and you just, you know, it's almost like keep walking to the microphone and just do what you did there.
The part's great, too. When you guys play it live, everyone's singing. Every dance club or bar I've ever been in, when this song comes on, the whole place is humming that part.
I know. When we did it, you know, it was a bit like, okay, there's a great song, compact little song. Then, you know, like what we're doing now is like deconstructing and analyzing something. You know, it's like when you're 19, you know, you don't do that kind of thing too much.
Absolutely not.
But I mean, the I Melt With You has got, you know, it's full of hooks, you know, hook lines all over the place, you know, and there's, you know, about four or five in that song, you know, in three and a half minutes, you know, and you know, the, you know, even like humming, can that section on its own is recognizable as being part of, you know, the greater thing that is I Melt With You.
I know. It's incredible. Well, coming out of this humming part, the bridge here, what I'm calling the bridge, there's no backing vocal. That Let's Stop the World does not start off chorus four. It just jumps right in. But a great drum fill takes us in here. And that's where I hear this. It's not a dance drum fill. It's like a rock drum fill. It's awesome.
I'll stop the world and melt with you. Stop the world. You've seen the difference and it's getting better all the time. There's nothing you and I won't do.
You know, Richard's not in the band, hasn't played with us for decades, but so we've had loads and loads of different drummers and, well, not loads, a few. And they all have problems with that fill.
It sounds like Animal from Sesame Street. It's like, what is this? It's very different.
Yeah, completely. You know, yeah. I mean, that Hugh and Richard, I can remember all of this happening. It was like, you know, Hugh wanted to have something that was totally not like a normal drum fill. And he knew that Richard was like not a normal drummer. So, you know, they tried a few. And I think that almost sounds, you know, Richard was, you know, quite a hard person to work with sometimes. But and I think, you know, it was a bit like, I'll show you. Instead of coming on the downbeat, he kind of like doesn't, and then comes down on like, you know, 1 3/4 instead of, you know, 2 even. And it just kind of like, it sounds like someone's dropping their sticks or kicking a drum kit down the stairs.
It is definitely like, whoa, it's very knee jerk, but it's great. I can't imagine another fill being there. The chorus lyric, I'll stop the world and melt with you. Let's stop the world. That response to it. You've seen the difference and it's getting better all the time. Great harmony on that whole line. Let's stop the world. There's nothing you and I won't do. Let's stop the world. I'll stop the world and melt with you. Let's stop the world. I'll stop the world and melt with you. And that's where the fade starts, along with yet another high synth part that comes in there, I believe.
Yeah.
I believe. Unless that's another delayed guitar part.
I actually think it's the guitar lead line, but it's the guitar's going ding, 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 mm-hmm. Which is kind of like the verse, you know, the kind of like intricate, busy verse line. It's like up the neck, and then for the very outro, it goes up another octave.
Okay, then that's what I'm hearing, because, and as soon as I got to this right now, I'm saying, I bet that isn't a keyboard part. I bet that's that guitar. Yeah. You corroborated that.
On a Les Paul as well, you know.
Well, after that, you get to another response of Let's Stop the World, and then I'll Stop the World and Melt with You. There's a great harmony on this line, but the melody's different on this one.
Completely.
And it's almost near the end of the fade out. You get this little bit of last minute ear candy that comes in, and you get another Let's Stop the World. And the last thing you hear is I'll Stop the World and Melt with You on the fade, and the song's done. And, you know, typically at this point, Mick, I'll ask the guest, you know, did you ever think, and we've already covered that at the top, you just, how would you ever think 40 years later you'd be talking about this song? And do you still get a kick out of playing it live?
Oh, yeah. It's incredible. You know, it's, you know, I mean, recently, I mean, last year we did the 40th anniversary of After the Snow, and, I mean, we've played I Melt With You a lot. You know, we've played at every concert we've done since we recorded it. And, you know, towards the end of last year, Robbie would start saying to the audience, you know, put your cameras away, because everyone, you know, all you see is iPhones or cameras.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like these people, you know, they want to be able to put it on their social media and all of that stuff. It kind of, it has, I mean, the song is definitely more famous than the band, you know, without a shadow of a doubt. But, you know, there's no way that you could, you know, predict that you'd still be, like, talking about this song, you know, 40 years time. I'm sure everyone has said the same thing to you.
Well, this is one of those songs, too, Mick, that to me, and, you know, again, a lot of this is, you know, dictated by what your royalty statements look like. But to me, the song is just as popular as it's ever been. It's just, it's still everywhere. I hear it all the time. And this has been so much fun. Before we break, well, first of all, before we break, thank you for listening to my podcast prior to this. You don't know what that means to me.
I love podcasts. I mean, my you know, every now and then I think I've got to empty out all of my downloaded podcasts because my phone is like dying again. I you know, it was like when I got to your podcast, I was thinking, God, this guy's made 170 shows. You know, I'm a train spotter as well, you know, a geek, you know, I like to know how people think and what they do as well.
That is awesome. Well, before we break, anything you'd like to leave the audience with, the listeners, of what you got coming up, tours, what's happening?
Well, at the end of this last year, we went into a studio up here in upstate New York in Rhinebeck with a guy called Mario McNulty, who worked a lot with David Bowie and Laurie Anderson and Philip Glass as well. But he's done, he, you know, works with Earl Slick, and he's produced the last album by an artist called The Anchoress, who's a British girl. So we've recorded a new LP, and right as we speak, it's being mixed. So that's going to be coming out this year. And we're playing at Cruel World in Pasadena on the 20th of March with Susie Sue, Iggy Pop, and Human League and Gang of Four, which is
so, oh man,
yeah, no, it's gonna be amazing, that gig, and Billy Idol, I've just heard as well. But you know, basically, we've got you know, we're you know, even though we're talking about I Melt With You, we still, you know, like doing new music, and you know, there's a you know, still, you know, we still have new stuff coming out, and it's, you know, we're really excited about that as well. You know, I guess I Melt With You has made that possible.
Well, again, thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, no, thank you. It's been good fun.
I Melt With You. What a song, and what a good guy Mick Conroy is. I can't wait to talk to Chris about this episode in the rap segment that's coming right up after a few words from our sponsors.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce. And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.
If you like music and you like podcasts and you like to laugh and you like to learn, you need to immediately subscribe to One Hit Thunder. Each week on the One Hit Thunder podcast, we dive deep into the story and back catalog of a one-hit wonder band or artist. From there, we have a good, healthy discussion as to whether they brought the one-hit thunder or were nothing more than a one-hit wonder. We have a huge back catalog, and we've done episodes on everything from Don't Worry, Be Happy and the Macarena to King of Wishful Thinking and Cumbersome. I promise you're going to love the show more than Jaquan loved getting tipsy, and even more than Bobby Boris Pickett loved making alternate versions of the Monster Mash. Subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your podcasts.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is email your best song via MP3 only and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Park After Dark, an indie electronic rock band from New York City. You can find them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Park After Dark. Here's a snippet of their song, Massacre.
It's a massacre. It's a fantasy.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
That was a really awesome episode, Chris. Right off the bat, we learned that Mick had listened to Krista Makes a Podcast. I was honored. I was honored that he tuned in, and he knew what he was getting into, so that was cool.
Yeah, I was honored and flattered. That was just really cool. I had no idea, and he couldn't have been nicer and more appreciative of this song that has given him a 40-plus year career in the music business. Very cool.
Absolutely gotta love it when people still have the love for their iconic song. You know, it's not like he's got any sort of resentment about it. He loves it, and I love that. That's always, I mean, I would feel the same way if I had a hit like that.
Yeah, you know, we kind of mentioned at the end, they have a brand new record that they're excited about, and that's what propels most bands, is that need to create. We have these songs inside us. They're emotional. We want to create and get them out. And he said, you know, we do have other songs behind, besides I Melt With You, we're making new music. And he was kind of joking, but there was an underlying tone of seriousness there. It's like, yeah, it's obvious, but it's so cool that you can appreciate that song still, even though it's regarded and known as your biggest song.
Yeah. Push forward musically and artistically, but appreciate what your past music affords you to be able to do. I think that's the best attitude possible.
Yep.
There were things that he talked about in this episode. One of those things being John Peel. Now, I've learned a lot about John Peel recently because we did an episode of One Hit Thunder about the band T-Rex.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know T-Rex's story at all, John Peel was like the biggest champion of that band and a big part of how so many people found out about them at first. And so it made me think a lot about how important curators and tastemakers are. We live in a world, Chris, when I came up, it was MTV, and more specifically, it was shows like 120 Minutes and Headbangers Ball and things like that, where you have these tastemakers, these curators, be it Matt Pinfield, who I'm sure had some say in the music that played on there. I mean, maybe not 100%, but definitely some, or Ricky Rackman or whoever.
Right.
Who, you know, there's something to be said for that, how these influential voices, on one hand, expose great artist to the world, and on the other hand, kind of block out some of the garbage, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and you know, you could take this all the way back to, you know, prior to social media. You just said MTV and things of that nature, John Peel sessions, Top of the Pops. There was, you know, American Bandstand. For me, it was the record store. Finding the cool record store in whatever town and getting your pulse on that town and what that was like, and talking to the clerk and being like, hey, what's going on? Oh, man, have you heard this? Check this out.
Right. I mean, it could be as simple as you go to your record store. And I remember at the record, I'm sure at some record stores they still have this, but you have the employees' picks on the wall.
Yeah.
Like, and if you saw someone who had the same taste in you, you might want to check it out. I mean, I think there's importance in that. Also, something I think is always important in a song, Chris, are parts that are so memorable. And of course, this is a great song front to back. But to me, the most memorable part of this song is the hummed part.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you wait for that moment. You brought up several times, Chris, being at a party when this song's on.
Yeah.
And how people sing along and being at the show. What a fun and different thing to sing along to. Like, it probably wasn't until the Crash Test Dummies came along, you know, a decade and a half later after this, that people could hum in the crowd to sing along, you know?
Yeah, there's not many songs that hum. And I'll tell you, that hum part would have thrown me for a loop if Hugh Jones is the producer. I'll tell you what I would have done. It's so good and so catchy. I know I would have said to the rest of the band, shouldn't we start the song off like this? Or shouldn't it be somewhere else in the song? And that's what would drive me crazy. And have the restraint to go, nope, this is where it comes in. It's the one time. That's where it's at. It's great.
It's also crazy thinking about tracking hums, because your mouth is closed. You can't do the techniques that you do, the singing techniques that you do. It seems like a tricky thing to do.
Yeah, someone can't tell you, hey, enunciate a little bit more. My mouth's closed.
Yeah, do that hum a little harder. Yeah, and, you know, Mick referenced that they were young when they wrote this. It's such a perfect song that you don't think about it being a bunch of young people writing it. And now deconstructing it 40 years later, it was hard, and I'm sure it would be hard for anyone to talk about why they did the things they did. But man, oh man, it's a good thing that they did do the things they did.
Yeah, for sure. And Mick had a pretty darn good memory going back 40 years. You know, there's sometimes I ask questions. He even laughed at some point later and just goes, I had a feeling you were going to ask that, you know, which made me laugh a little bit. But yeah, who knew? Like he said, you can never, ever plan these things out. I know I didn't do it. Any other musician I've talked to, you know, did you think you'd be doing this in 5 years or 10 years? And you weren't thinking about that when you were 19 years old, 20 years old. You were thinking about, hey, there's 10 people here. That's two more people than the last time we played. And they're giving us a six pack this time. Hooray.
Yeah, right. You know, this song sounds as great now as it did then. And at the same time, when I hear this song, it transports me back. You know, it's like the song is like a time capsule or something. It puts you in that mood. You put this song on, if you have an 80s party, you put this song on, it takes you there. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's something that's so amazing about music, is the way that sounds can transport you to another time. It's incredible.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, the listeners, and we know this from all of you, from your feedback, you say every week, you know, the memories I have attached to this song, that's what this podcast is really based about. It's always about that. It's what memories do you have? You hear it in Punchline. People come up to me all the time and Less Than Jake, this song means so much to me. I broke my leg in summer camp and this song got me through it, or whatever it is. It could be the most ridiculous thing. And that's what music does. It's great. I'll tell you something else that's great, Chris.
What's that?
Our supporting cast, which is our VIP program over at chrisdemakes.com, where you get bonus episodes each week of the After Party for the price of a cup of coffee. Head over to chrisdemakes.com. We'd love to have you in our supporting cast, as well as the Chris DeMakes podcast Facebook group. That's free to join, and we have a lot of fun in there. We take your suggestions, we get some great discussions going, and yeah, we're gonna wrap this one up now. I want to thank this week's guest, Mick Conroy from Modern English, and we'll see you next week.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.